Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shinoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Thank you again for joining our fourth season, in which we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping industry. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being challenged, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era.
Hello, everybody. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economist, but I've spent part of my life in policy and finance and part of my life in industry and technology. And so my area of expertise is really the intersection of macroeconomic trends, global trends, and innovation and technology. And I'm here today joined by my co-host, Vikram Shyam of NASA. Vic, over to you.
Thanks, Marco. Hey guys, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for about 15 years, futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, and I've got a background in biomimicry, aerospace, and foresight. Really happy to talk about this. Close to my heart.
Outstanding. And today, our guests in the plural are Kasia Gora, who's the co-founder and CTO of Sci-Fi Foods, and Joshua March, who's the co-founder and CEO of Sci-Fi Food. Sci-Fi Foods is a pioneering food tech company which is revolutionizing the culinary landscape with burgers that I'm now going to tell you more about because Josh and Kasia will explain in detail what they're doing. But what I do want to say is the expertise that Kasia and Josh bring with them. Kasia has a PhD from MIT in biology and over a decade of experience in leveraging advanced science to address global sustainability challenges. Josh brings over a decade of experience running venture-backed startups in the tech industry. So together, I would say they are a powerhouse. Kasia, Josh, welcome. And why don't you kick it off by telling us more about yourselves and about Sci-Fi Foods?
Great to be on here. And thanks for inviting us on, Marco and Vic. So I'm Joshua March. I'm the co-founder and CEO here at Sci-Fi Foods. At Sci-Fi, we're really using the power of synthetic biology to make cultivated meat commercially viable. And we'll talk a lot more about that. My background, as you said, always being an entrepreneur, was running a venture-backed enterprise software company that I founded prior to founding Sci-Fi, which I ran for 8-9 years before it was acquired. But I'd been dreaming about the potential for cultivated meat since I first read about the idea in a science fiction book about 15 years ago. And it was shortly after I'd read The Singularity Is Near by Ray Kurzweil, which had got me really excited by the potential for exponential changes and improvements in technology to really dramatically change the world for the better in our lifetimes. And then when I read this sci-fi book that talked about growing meat without the need for animals, it was like a light bulb went off and it just felt very obvious to me that had to be the future. And I was busy running this other company, which was a long journey, but I always kept it in my mind as something I wanted to help make happen. And I started to come across some of the first scientists and entrepreneurs working on and thinking about cultivated meat back in like 2016. And for a few years, I was kind of on the sidelines, just kind of observing the industry. It became pretty clear during that time that trying to do 100% cultivated meat products was not viable. That's obviously the goal. That's the kind of dream that we want to get to eventually. But the technology is not ready to do that today. But it was clear that there was a potential opportunity to create blended products where you could create products that are a combination of plant-based ingredients with cultivated cells and basically set out in order to make that a reality. And that was the kind of founding story of Sci-Fi. Now, there's still some big challenges in even making that commercially viable. And that's really where Kasia's skill set comes in. So maybe you can kick off your intro from that.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a biologist by training. So chatted about my education. I've basically been in the industrial biotech sector for 13 years, the entire time trying to use synthetic biology to solve some sustainability challenges that we have. So about 4 years ago, I left my previous job at a company called Zymergen that turned out to be a unicorn company pioneering the use of SynBio to make biomanufacturing cost competitive with commercial petrochemical-based processes. And I left about 4 years ago to join SciFi because I can really pass up an opportunity to tackle some of the more meaningful work that we can do, which is thinking about the future of agriculture. And so at SciFi, we've been trying to use the techniques of synthetic biology to basically solve the cost problem and make cultivated meat a commercial reality, because we really see this as a way of positively changing the food system to be much more sustainable in the future while still getting everybody the protein that they really love and want and need.
That's fantastic. And picking up from there, can you give us a sense of the scale of the challenge, right? Because we're talking about bringing literally to the table more protein to feed a growing global population. And also, I look at it as an economist, to not just feed a growing number of people, but also to allow more and more people who are now in condition of undernutrition or poor diets to have better and better access to protein in diet. Can you give us a sense of how large the challenge is?
Yeah, I mean, meat today is a $1 trillion market around the world. And as you said, it's a market that is continuing to grow, because we have not just a growing population, but also a population that is getting wealthier. And as it gets wealthier, is demanding to eat more and more meat. So demand for high quality protein is going up significantly. I think it's set to it's to double it over the next 30 years. And there are pockets. So if you go like India, for example, it's going to be doubling in the next 10 years. So we have really increasing demand at a time when climate change is putting pressure on arable land. Even in the US, we've seen herd sizes, and we're seeing issues like that around the world. So we have this kind of big problem where you have significantly increasing demand, what's already a massive market around today, combined with decreasing supply. And so it doesn't take you don't have to be a PhD in economics to see where that's going.
For a NASA rocket scientist.
Or a NASA rocket scientist, yeah. So we really need to figure out more sustainable and efficient ways of creating the protein that people want to eat.
The first is along with that, yeah, I like to see some numbers. You know, I guess the UN says there's something like by 2050, the amount of meat and dairy needed is supposed to double for the requirement. Is that right? And then on the other side, if it is supposed to double, you're talking about this 100% ideal. I think, Joshua, you mentioned that in an ideal situation, you're 100% plant-based. And I want to challenge that a bit, so just play devil's advocate. But well, let's say you are to get to that. Some of the studies are showing that at most you might get 22%, let's say, assuming you're able to deal with regulatory and technology and everything. There's a big gap, it seems like, between your 100% ideal and the 22%. So I'm wondering, so how much of that is behavioral? How much of that is the technology? And from the behavior side of it, there's like so many different things. There's the cultural baggage, there's taste, there's regional stuff, there's economics. Anyway, I said a lot of things.
If we just start from the first, which is the technical possibility of getting to 100%, right? I mean, the answer is it's not clear, right? So it's certainly not happening in the next 5 years, right? That like with the technology that is available today, it is not viable. I do think kind of 10, 20% range is viable. And I think you can pretty clearly see the kind of innovations that can come down the pipeline over the next 10 years that could see that increasing maybe to kind of 40, 50% in a viable way. Do I think 100% is impossible from that? No, for sure. It's physically, biologically possible, but we need to figure out how to be able to manufacture it at a much, much lower cost than we are today. And a big part of that is the CapEx in terms of the biomanufacturing. That's really one of the biggest impediments. And I do think there's going to be lots of innovations in that space in the decades to come. So ultimately, Bill Gates has a great line where people always kind of, he says people significantly overestimate what can be done in a year and underestimate what can be done in 10 years. And especially with exponential changes in technology, I think like it's very hard for us to even fathom what will or won't be possible 10 years hence. So I do think it's possible. It's not something that is possible in the short term, but I do think it's something that's both kind of possible, inevitable, and kind of essential over a longer time horizon.
So if it is possible, and you're talking about synthetic biology, there are issues associated with synthetic biology more generally, right? So you could see unintended consequences on the environment in terms of, let's say the sourcing of the material that's needed. So you're talking about manipulation of, let's say it's molecular bioengineering. If you could perhaps give some more detail on what exactly you're talking about when you say synthetic biology, that might help as well.
Yeah, so
I can take this. Sorry, Kasia, but I was going to suggest exactly that we take maybe one step back before getting to the unintended consequences so that we understand the unintended consequences of what, because when people talk about the protein challenge and that you just described before, normally the answer that people think about is plant-based meat. Why is that not enough? Where do you guys come in? And then tell us about your approach, the technical side of your approach.
Well, Josh, do you want to handle the why is plant-based not good enough?
Yeah, there was a lot of excitement a few years ago about plant-based meat. That was driven by a number of things that were going on, and it really accelerated significantly during the pandemic. Part of it, there was a kind of zeitgeist around health, right? Game changers had come out, and there was this big kind of zeitgeist that meat is bad for you and anything plants is good. And that combined with a load of supply chain disruptions around conventional meat during the pandemic, where actually meat became more expensive and hard to find. And those two things kind of combined together to really dramatically accelerate adoption of plant-based meat. And people believed that adoption would continue and that you'd see an increasing number of flexitarians, i.e. people who generally eat meat, but who interested in eating less. And health's a big reason for that, but environment, animal welfare also kind of factor in. And so everything kind of looked kind of up and to the right. Now, the reality is from a health perspective, that stuff was kind of overblown. Like, nutritional science is really challenging. There's definitely very good science that eating more vegetables is good for you and everyone should eat more vegetables.
Yeah. Mostly because you're not eating processed.
Yeah. And like people,
carbs.
Yeah. And people should eat like less sugar. But as soon as you veer out from those two things, it really becomes extremely subjective. And the science isn't particularly clear either way. And so it was kind of overhyped. And, you know, we've now seen the health stuff kind of flip the other way, right? Where now the zeitgeist is like, anything processed is bad for you and plant-based meat is processed. Now, of course, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
So it's olive oil.
Yeah. You go to a smoothie shop and they put pea protein in your smoothie. And in that context, people think it's a health food. But that exact same protein being put into a plant-based meat burger is suddenly bad for you. So it's not necessarily logical, but it has really flipped the other way. And that's combined with, you know, the just practical reality that plant-based meat products still don't actually taste that great. Impossible tastes better than everything else, and it's selling better than everything else. But like most plant-based meat still doesn't actually taste like meat. And it's also more expensive. And the supply chain disruptions from the pandemic have now gone down. Conventional meat is cheaper. And inflation is high and people are being more conservative with their purse strings. And so they go for the cheaper thing they know that isn't scary and processed. So there's lots of things, and that's all contributed to the struggles that plant-based meat is having.
And so, I mean, this is kind of where cultivated meat comes in and this idea of blended products. So to zoom out, what we propose as a solution is actually taking animal cells that we grow in bioreactors instead of slaughtering cows and all the challenges that come from conventional animal agriculture, and blending those with high quality plant proteins to create something that tastes like a conventional burger. And so that's really where sci-fi food comes in, and being able to produce this blended product that actually tastes like the real thing, but doesn't have the sustainability issues and the cruelty issues of conventional meat. And even though we blend animal cells with plant-based proteins, we still have to do a ton of biotechnology in order to be able to grow those animal cells cheaply enough to create a commodity food product. So that's where SynBio comes in. And so SynBio is basically the use of gene editing to change the behavior of cells. And we do a lot of work to make the beef cells much more cooperative in terms of being able to grow them in cheap, large-scale processes using stainless steel bioreactors. So one example I can give you just right off the bat is animal cells will only grow attached to a surface. So if you take a biopsy from an animal, isolate some cells, they're only going to grow in a single monolayer. And if you were to look at a petri dish that had a layer of beef cells growing on it, you would basically see nothing but a haze. And you can imagine that it's really impossible to figure out how are you going to use a process like that to create tons and tons of product commensurate with how much meat people want to eat. And so one of the things we can do with synthetic biology is create beef cells that are willing to grow and divide floating around in liquid cell culture medium instead of attached to a surface. So now you have a three-dimensional process that you can scale by putting the cells in larger and larger stainless steel bioreactors. And that's really the kinds of strategies, the kind of manipulations we want to make in order to improve our ability to produce those cells cheaply enough to make our blended products. And then just one note in terms of unintended consequences, we actually don't add any foreign DNA to our cells. So when we make genetic changes, we're really making very small conservative genetic changes in the beef genome. So we're not adding any foreign DNA. There's no new proteins. There's nothing in these cells that is distinguishable from conventional meat. So you can look at the macronutritional profile and our cells look like conventional beef because they are conventional. In many ways, they are beef, right? Because conventional beef is made out of animal cells. And we're just figuring out a more sustainable way of growing those cells instead of using cows. I think, Vic, you asked about unintended consequences. So I think this is an area where cultivated meat is really nice because animal cells are really picky. We have to work really hard to grow them in specialized bioreactors. So there's basically no chance of environmental release. If you were to release these cells, they would immediately die in the environment. So they're not capable of growing on their own. This is not like a Jurassic Park. These dinosaurs are going to find some lysine. It's just inconceivable that you could have an environmental release. I mean, like engineered animals that can go out in the wild or plants or bacteria that get deployed in the environment, those have those risks. But cultivated meat cells don't have any of those risks. It's like asking, like, are we worried that some of our cells are going to escape and like start colonizing the environment, right? And they can't because mammalian cells are only capable of living within organisms, or these engineered cells are capable of living in really specialized, controlled bioreactors. But there's just no way that you can get environmental release of those cells.
I mean, rather scary sci-fi dystopian scenarios. This is very reassuring. And
Marco, just to add to what you, so you were asking about the why not just plant-based, and I'm wondering from Joshua and Akash, what's your take on the, let's say, the plant? There's one aspect of plant consciousness, I guess, which is being studied, which might also play into this, where people are starting to look at, you know, are plants actually thinking? Are they alive? Is there a different type of nervous system? So that may end up resulting in like these ethical concerns further down the road. We don't have that right now, but that may be one thing.
But the other something.
Gandhi was a fruititarian, I think, where he basically only ate stuff that wouldn't kill a plant. So it is possible.
Okay.
But yeah. You can still eat cultivated beef burgers, even if you're a fruit attack.
Right, exactly. So that might be a benefit. The other one I was thinking about was similar to what the aviation industry is considering with sustainable aviation fuels, which is when you start to focus on certain plant proteins, like we were talking earlier before we started about pea proteins and such, you start to encourage the growth of these homogeneous zones of these crops and such, which can also have negative effect on biodiversity. And so this may be a way around. This may be a way to avoid that by not relying so much on the plant-based proteins. But I don't know what you're doing.
I'd love to go along with that narrative, but I just think the product still requires a lot of plant-based protein, and then also the inputs into cell culture come from plants, right? It's like sugar and amino acids, but ultimately they're coming from crops. So it's not a perfect solution, but I think you can balance pros and cons of various strategies. And we know that conventional agriculture of cows is basically the worst thing you can do for the environment. Planting a field of soy is not as bad in terms of environmental
impact. Yeah, and actually, even if you look at plant-based meat or plant-based and cultivated or cultivated, even if row crops are involved, the amounts of row crops you need is actually significantly fewer than in the case of animal agriculture, because a huge amount of, like, soy, for example, is grown as feed for livestock.
So, and only 3% of those calories get converted to meat, whereas 100% of those soy bean calories are converted to this burger product, essentially. So it's way more efficient. Is it perfect? No, but certainly better than beef.
Yeah.
Do you guys have an idea? So what are the exact crops, I guess, that you guys use? What are the plant-based sources?
We use soy for the plant-based. In terms of what goes into the sugar, probably corn, right?
Yeah.
It's corn.
Dextrose processed from corn.
Marco, sorry, I saw you come off mute.
I just wanted to ask, so you remember, I'm the cold-hearted economist, so as Vic brings up ethical concerns, my brain switches off. But I'm thinking instead of something else you said earlier, Kasia, when you are pointing out the scaling issue, so you are pointing out that normally the first constraint that comes up is that animal cells tend to grow only attached to a medium, so in one layer. But through genetic engineering, synthetic biology, you find a way to have them grow in three dimensions. Now, going beyond that, what are currently the more serious scaling issues to your product and your production process? What would be the next steps?
Yeah, I would say the cost of cell culture media is a concern. And so basically, SciFi and any company working on cultivated meat is obsessed with reducing the cost of media. The current challenge today is that animal cells need proteins called growth factors in order to enable them to grow outside of the animal. So these are the same growth factors that signal within an organism. We have to provide those recombinantly in a cell culture vessel in order to get cells to grow. And it turns out those proteins are really expensive. So they're made through recombinantly in bacteria or yeast or sometimes other animal culture cells and purified. And so that's really expensive. So we also have synthetic biology strategies for reducing or eliminating the need for those added growth factors. And then people are also thinking about other ways of reducing the cost of growth factors, but that's one big concern. Once you get rid of that, you're basically down to the cost of sugar and amino acids. And basically, you want to get those costs as low as possible. One of the challenges is that cells are very sensitive, so they need extra pure input. So unlike bacteria that literally eats garbage, animal cells need really high purity sugar and amino acids. And the question there is, how can we get large volumes of those things that are sufficient purity, but low enough cost to actually make the cost of raw ingredients make sense for cultivated meat? And then beyond media, I would also say CapEx. So the amount of money that it costs to create one of these facilities, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars. So we can say like $150 million or $200 million to make an industrial scale facility. And ultimately, the IRR has to be good on that facility. So you have to make enough money to justify that cost. And unfortunately, like for 100% cultivated meat products, the amount of food you could make in that facility makes the IR very unattractive. However, if you're doing a blended product, then all of a sudden you can sell 5 to 10x more stuff out of the same fermentation facility or cell culture facility because of the blending strategy. And that really improves the IR of making those facilities.
Right on to Marco's economics thread here. So is there a demand issue to this, to scaling in terms of generating sufficient demand and societal buy-in, changing behaviors perhaps?
Yeah, and partly the question is we don't know, right? Because this is a completely new product that's not on the market in any kind of way. Certainly, I think that from in the first few years of the industry, in the early days, when production is still pretty constrained, I don't think there'll be any demand issue, right? There's enough early adopters who will just be excited to try these kinds of products. When you're talking about getting to kind of mainstream adoption, though, for sure, there's going to need to be a lot of education and a lot of work and brand building to make sure it has mainstream appeal.
Speaking of which, where are we in the journey towards this eventual mass adoption? So if I want to try one of your burgers...
Well, we can't sell you one legally yet, but you can come and do a private tasting. Basically, anytime we invite you, we have them in the kitchen right now. So you come tomorrow if you'd like. So we're allowed to do private tastings and we make quantities today relatively cost effectively, but obviously we need regulatory approval. But even with regulatory approval, it will be relatively small scale to start and the hundreds of thousands of burgers, not millions yet. So how far away to kind of true mainstream, where you're talking tens or even hundreds of millions, that's probably at least 5 years away.
But I would say the place I would say the industry in general is today is the trough of disillusionment.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of excitement over the last 3, 4, 5 years. And now really, I feel like we're at the very bottom of the trough of disillusionment. And it's the question of, okay, people have prototypes and ideas of how to scale this thing with the real challenges. How are we going to get scale up and who's going to help support this? And that's a really big open question right now for the industry.
Yeah.
And I guess I wonder if you want to tell the audience what you mean by trough disillusion. Was you're referring to the Gartner, the hype cycle? And
the hype cycle, yeah.
How
yeah.
people immediately pick up on it. It becomes a trend. It's on all the media and everything. And then eventually there's like a dip and actually starts to face market challenges and all that.
So the trough of disillusionment, yeah, as you said, is this kind of classic cycle that you see very often with almost new technology, almost all new technology innovations. Yeah, when and it comes in the earlier days and people get really excited by this potential. And so you see a load of hype build up, tons of funding, tons of media, everything coming in.
AI.
But the reality is like the hype is always exceeds the technological actual discoveries that have happened, right? The kind of technology is moving like this and the hype kind of explodes. And because the hype has gone so much further than the actual technological advancements, at some point it needs to crash. And then you see a crash down. And the crash down is the kind of that disappointment that the reality hasn't quite met that hype. And then that disappointment can actually kill the industry or kill all the companies in the industry.
And right? It goes below the potential.
And it goes below the potential, right? Because like people come way more disenchanted than the reality of where the technology is. And then all the time, the actual technological progress has been kind of continuing along. And over time, that can keep going up and up. And eventually it kind of starts to meet expectations and kind of people build real businesses and stuff like that. But it just happens in a kind of slower, gradual way. And the exact speed of and angle of that slope is different for every industry. But certainly for cultivated meat, we are kind of down in that trough right now.
And thinking of speeds and shapes of curves of hype, disillusionment and adoption, I think there's something else here which is interesting, which is that we were talking earlier about the challenges to scaling up the adoption and the acceptance of the product. And Josh, you were pointing out that there will need to be an effort in branding when the time comes to move from the hundreds of thousands to the millions and the billions. But it strikes me that at some point, I don't know how the timing plays out, but at some point, branding might not even be that necessary, because if where we started off is correct, that is, if there is building up an enormous protein gap, at some point that will have to translate into an enormous excess demand, which will drive the prices of existing proteins through the roof unless there are alternatives. So at that point, the demand itself should make plant-based or rather cultivated meat products, in your case, a lot more competitive, almost by definition. The moment when a natural burger is going to cost $100, I think the economics of the game might change significantly.
Yeah, 100%. That's definitely the way it's going. And ultimately, I think the climate change having an impact on the arable land and the cost of manufacturing, we're also seeing increasing progress on animal welfare. Right, where there's continuing laws being passed and shareholder votes being passed, where people are trying to improve, decrease some of the kind of horrific conditions of factory farming. And the reality is, why are those some of those conditions horrific? Is because it makes things cheaper, right? So the more constrained that traditional animal agriculture can be, also generally the pricier conventional meat's going to be. And so I think the combination of those things, for sure, is that over time we're going to more and more see the real price of meat. Because ultimately, like, there is a meat today is heavily subsidized in many ways. And once we see the real price of meat, then the price of alternatives will seem much, much more attractive.
And Marco, I might argue against that a bit. And you guys can correct me again if I'm wrong, because I'm just hypothesizing. So if you look at the world culturally, we're in our area of the world, protein is important. Many people grow up thinking about meats and such in terms of protein versus lack of protein on the plant-based side. That's a behavioral thing, the psychological thing. But other parts of the world, you look at, for example, there was a study of the people of Okinawa, Japan, where it's very low protein in their diet, high carbohydrates, and they actually have higher longevity and such. So in certain parts of the world, there is not that push, I guess, for the high protein diet. And maybe you do need some kind of campaign to build awareness of why maybe protein is necessary or even desirable. maybe for other reasons. Maybe longevity is the only thing. Maybe quality of life or other factors. I'm not sure.
I mean, I think, turn this back to Marco, ultimately, it's all economics, right? People will eat based on what's affordable and available in their environment. And humans are actually quite flexible on what we eat and how we eat. So yeah, we have lots of different food cultures around the world, including the standard American SAD diet, which we have here in the US, which is clearly not working for anyone. There's this broad diversity of overnutrition and undernutrition, and ultimately humans are flexible. But I think ultimately economics is going to be the major driver, as people are going to buy the best things that they can afford to eat. And those best things are going to change over time as we have changes in climate change and other forces making conventional proteins much more expensive in the future.
I'm going to do some more research on the Okinawan protein consumption.
Yeah. You can make the argument that protein is much more expensive today, even over the last few years with inflation.
Okay, I like the way you're thinking clearly along the lines of privacy of economics. And I'm curious, since we are nearing the final turn of our interview with you guys, let's think about the picture of the future. So the next steps, and let's take it for granted that more protein will need to be produced, even allowing for the Vic's caveat, which is an excellent point. Who needs to do what? So entrepreneurs and scientists like you guys are working hard on improvements in technology to be able to scale faster and at lower costs. Any steps needed from policymakers, regulators, changes in supply chains? What needs to change at an ecosystem level for this to take shape?
Well, I mean, I think we need to evolve how we think about government subsidies and what kind of agriculture we support. And so, I mean, the government, rightfully so, subsidizes conventional agriculture, making nutritious food more accessible to Americans, but also all world governments really try to do that. But I think we don't have any government support or subsidies for the future of agriculture. It's very much, it's like a fight. It's like old system versus new system. And I think, you know, what we need to see is a ramp up of government funding and subsidies to support these new types of agriculture as we're doing the work to scale up so we can actually start getting traction, because it's really hard to get a new technology to compete economically against an old subsidized technology. It makes it that much harder because there's no level playing field. So I think I want to see a level playing field when it comes to government funding.
I want to jump in really quick here. So the point I'd made before about the Okinawan diet, I wasn't trying to maybe say like we should focus on carb-based diets. My point was, so there's this growing trend in the world around personalization. If you look at, for example, even cosmetic products, right? You can fill out a simple form about your preferences, about your genetics, and you get these tailored shampoos and conditioners and such.
These placebos.
Yeah, sure. It could be
a placebo. Just for you, we put your name on the bottle.
Exactly, yeah. In the future, as genetic testing, we get, I guess, more ubiquitous. And you see tailored foods for people based on their genetic backgrounds?
Right, for sure, people have different dietary requirements on their genetic and their gut bacteria, microbiome, like everything, right? So at some point, yes, the question is, like, at what point does it become cheap enough, and do we have enough knowledge to make that ubiquitous?
All Silicon Valley is wearing continuous glucose monitors and looking at the impact of various foods on our blood sugar. So with a prescription, I don't know why you need a prescription for that, by the way, but if you get a prescription for continuous glucose monitor, if you're allowed to look at your glucose, you can already start doing that today, as well as standard metabolic panels that your doctor can do. Certainly any American with reasonable healthcare can go into a doctor's office and start asking the question, am I metabolically healthy? And we have to believe that diet and exercise is the primary driver of whether you're metabolically healthy or not. So that is already starting to happen. I wonder, ultimately, are we moving to a future of abundance where we have abundant technology and abundant food, where people have time and the capability of doing these things to nurture themselves and improve their health? Or are we going towards a future of scarcity where pressures of climate change are going to make the amount of quality food less available and cause pressure, which causes people to sacrifice their health in order just to be able to afford to eat what's available. And hopefully I'm voting for the future of abundance. That's what we're working on here at SciFi.
I'm with you on the future of abundance. But my concern is that we will have a future of abundance, but that's not the issue. The issue is whether we will have an abundance of information and common sense thinking that can help people make the right decisions. Because I think a lot of, if you look at, for example, the fact that there is such suboptimal levels of health outcomes in the US, especially compared to the level of healthcare spending, it's the lack of information for decision making rather
than. It's not lack of information, it's the incentive system.
Yeah.
I mean, we're ultimately.
And you're talking like an economist.
And it shouldn't be up to the individual citizen to be the most educated person in the world in all matters of nutrition and health. That's ridiculous. We have to have institutions that are actually incentivized to get outcomes that are positive in terms of human health and wellness. And we currently don't have that, which is evident, right? Like if we did, then we would have the best health outcomes in the world, given how much we spend. We clearly do not.
Yeah. And like, you know, you can buy sugary soda on Snap, which is insane, but you can't buy a roast chicken.
That's convenience food. You can't have roast chicken.
There's like lots of examples like that. The incentives are really broken. But obviously we are entering an era of AI where AI is able to give highly personalized guidance or recommendations. And so you can certainly foresee a future in a very near future where you can combine your genomic data with your continuous glucose monitor.
Buddy, like stop eating donuts.
Where it's like through your Meta Ray-Ban glasses, looking at what you're eating.
No donut.
Telling you. You can say, hey, you've done 10,000 steps today. You can eat one donut or you can eat half a donut or whatever it is, you know. So for sure, that could be a very near future.
Gosh, your liking for dystopian science fiction is coming through again. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
Dystopian or utopian? I consider them utopian. Who knows?
Yeah, I was meant to say it ties into the broader theme of transparency. You were talking about this even with technology, right? How do you broadcast impacts of what you're doing? So there's so much technology around us. Just like we're talking about food, people don't have the time to be aware of it. You mentioned that, right? So yeah, it's just how do you make the stuff we interact with on a day-to-day basis more transparent in terms of the impacts on us and everyone else?
Yeah, and we've always had an ethos of being very transparent at SciFi, and that's part of the reason for our name. We're not trying to like pretend or hide that this is all natural. People are going to view that lab-grown meat as being sci-fi and scientific. So we think it's better to embrace it and to be completely transparent and to be able to be very authentic and bold. And we think that's a good way of getting attention, and the best way of communicating something new to people is being super authentic and transparent about it. And then you just got to release great products that are really tasty, and you know, the market will decide.
Yeah, impact comes from actually commercializing at a big scale and having enough customer pull and ability to manufacture to make that work. And that's ultimately what this industry is focused on, is how do we actually scale up manufacturing in a meaningful way?
Is outstanding. And as we wrap up, I think this is a perfect wrapping up. But Josh, Kasia, if there is anything else that you feel we've left out and that the audience absolutely needs to hear, here's the time.
What you got, Josh?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think that's been pretty comprehensive.
Yes.
I'll add that the future of agriculture and improving and changing things is really tough. It's not glamorous. It doesn't make money like an app. We are all working really hard and trying to scramble to get funding in order to make these products that ultimately are going to shape the future of humanity and how we live and eat. And it's not easy, but it's worth it. And yeah, as much support as we can get for people to be optimistic and open-minded, I think that would be super helpful.
Well, what's the one thing you would ask listeners to do to help? Let's say to help the cause of more sustainable food.
Yeah, I think I would just be like conscientious of what people are reading and try and understand the environmental impact of the different kind of food choices that we make, because that stuff has a real difference. I think that's the biggest thing.
Look under the surface for the incentives of why are people telling you what they're telling you? What is everybody trying to get from the information they're feeding you? And I think, and ultimately decide for yourself what you think is ground truth.
Yeah.
Make sure it's not a placebo, like you said, when I mentioned the hair products.
I mean, I'm sure there's some amount of customization you could do, but how much of that is creative marketing, right?
Yeah.
No, exactly. And this was fantastic. We normally close with our takeaways, our response and listeners. I would say that from my perspective, the big takeaway is there is undoubtedly a massive challenge to create a more sustainable food industry. And a big piece of it will have to come from technology like what you guys at Sci-Fi Foods are developing. I think the other big takeaway from me is, you refer to it right now again, is paying attention to what is already going on in terms of, one, distorting subsidies. So not think that we are already facing a playing level field. And secondly, realizing that there is what you guys are doing for transparency. You're calling yourself Sci-Fi Foods. But I think as we've also touched upon it earlier in the conversation, there are elements of technology already embodied in a lot of the food we currently eat. So on a continuum, and so there's no, and that should temper the reaction. Behavioral changes will be important, but I think the big part will be coming from the innovation that you guys are doing. So extremely impressive. Thank you all. The last thing I want to say is I want the record to show that it was not the guy with the Italian accent who tried to push the idea of a high carb diet. Vic, any parting thoughts from you?
Oh boy. I'm going to regret saying that thing about the high carb.
Okinawans, yeah.
I was going to say the thing that I take away from this is, if you're familiar with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, the number of goals that this topic touches on is amazing. So there's the combating hunger, malnutrition, so getting to zero hunger. There's the mitigation of climate change. There's promoting responsible consumption, right? So making sustainable food choices. There's the protecting of biodiversity. Through the synthetic meats. And then there's also the good health part, so healthier protein options. So it's a very broad-ranging topic. And the one thing that makes me sad is that I have this future in mind where when I have a dinner party and I invite people to my house, I just want this, like the scanning thing to take the genomic data and to grow from the walls this food that's specifically made for them, with the exact like protein, carb, all the macronutrients that they need. And you have something like, have you heard of miracle fruit? So it's basically like you have these additives so that if people taste different things, even given the same product. So yeah, it seems like that's far away, but we're making progress.
Yeah, right there.
On our technical road, yeah. But
okay. What makes me sad instead is that we are out of time. So Kasia, Joshua, thank you so much for joining us. This was fantastic. Vic, thanks for being the best co-host as always. Thanks to all of our listeners. And of course, if you enjoyed this conversation, please join us for more Ecosystemic Futures podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and at socialworks.com. Thanks again, everybody.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at socialworks.com.